This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Dave Mistich. We'll hear from Dr. Kathy Slimp, who was recently ousted from her position as the state's top public health official.
You know, I think there's been several weeks in which we've not been taking the precautions we need to take as a society. And I understand it. We're tired of it. Yeah. It's hard.
That conversation and more on this West Virginia Morning. The Marshall University Board of Governors voted Tuesday to remove the name of a slaveholder and Confederate soldier from the building that houses the university's education program. The change comes as other markers and monuments honoring the Confederacy have been removed by choice or by force across the nation. According to a news release, the board said University President Jerome Gilbert recommended removing Albert Gallatin Jenkins's name from the building on Marshall's main campus in Huntington. Jenkins was born in 1830 in what is now Cabell County, West Virginia. He served in the U.S. Congress before resigning in 1861. Later, he served in the first Confederate States Congress. The decision to change the name of Jenkins Hall is an about-face for the board at the state's second-largest university. In February 2019, the board decided to keep Jenkins' name on the building in lieu of placing a small plaque to honor him. Dr. Cicero Fain, a historian originally from Huntington who has written a book on the black community's influence in the area, says he hopes the name change attracts those who have left the area back to Marshall, Huntington, and West Virginia. On Monday, the Kanawha County Board of Education voted unanimously to change the name of a middle school on Charleston's west side that honors Confederate General Stonewall Jackson. The city of Charleston has agreed to pay an $80,000 settlement to a black woman police forcefully arrested and allegedly injured last October. Emily Allen has more.
Patrol officers arrested Freda Gilmore last fall outside a Family Dollar on Charleston's west side. Bystander videos from the time, which ended up going viral, showed one officer hitting Gilmore's face with his fists while the other officer held her to the ground. Dash camera footage confirms this. An internal investigation in October by other officers cleared the cops who arrested Gilmore, Joshua Mina, and Carly McCoy of any wrongdoing. Attorney Michael Carey for Gilmore filed a civil suit against the city earlier this year.
This settlement gives Freda an opportunity to pick up the pieces, to move forward and start over again.
Carey also helped reach a private settlement with Family Dollar. He urges the city to work on its use of force policy. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Allen.
The new statewide face mask requirement is now in effect. Governor Jim Justice has issued an order that people wear masks inside where they cannot maintain social distancing. The governor says he's confident businesses will enforce it. Justice was reluctant to make the decision. He acknowledges it may not be a popular move, but says it's the right move. Until just recently, Dr. Kathy Slimp was the state's Commissioner of Public Health. Trey Kay is the host of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Us and Them. He talked with Dr. Slimp, who says West Virginia is at a pivotal time with the COVID-19 crisis.
We are trying to figure out this dance, this balance between how to come back to activities that we need to sustain. We need to get our kids back to school. We need to have businesses open. We need to be able to worship together, etc. Right. But frankly, we truly are seeing disease increase. And we were watching for this, and we're seeing it now. And it's significant. And it has the potential to get significantly worse. It is about how do we not just relax and go back to normal, thinking that it's not really here. It is here, and it's gonna be here for a while. And it has the potential to cause serious problems. But if we can do those activities that we need to go back to in ways that protect ourselves and each other, and yes, it takes a lot of work, and we're tired of it, and it takes creativity, and it takes dedication, but they can make a difference. So yes, it is about wearing masks, and yes, it is about keeping distance, and yes, it is about connecting in different ways.
How do you feel about how it is right now that we as a state are addressing this? I mean, are we taking the precautions that we need to?
I think there's been several weeks in which we've not been taking the precautions we need to take. Wow. As a society. And I understand it. We're tired of it. Yeah. It's hard. We don't see it rampant across our communities. But you can look around and see it elsewhere. We are starting to see case numbers pick up. We are starting to see hospitalizations pick up. We're starting to see ICU pick up. Not tons. We've got opportunity to act. But it's time to be serious about it.
In this state, we're seeing
it. In this state, yes.
So what about students going back to school?
This is all about managing risk. It is not about is something 100% safe or not safe.
Right.
And what are the risk and benefit equations here? So we think about school. Is it absolutely risk-free to go back to school? No.
Well, should parents be concerned?
Should parents be concerned? They should be concerned that about anywhere in some ways. However, think about what school offers as well. Think about the importance of that educational experience. Not every child can do it online.
Right.
Think about that importance of that educational experience, that social interaction. Think about their kids that
nutrition.
Yeah. So many kids access their nutrition through schools. Think about the issues of child protection and safety that schools offer. Think about the impact that of parents on the workforce.
Right.
When kids are not in school. So there's every reason to believe that kids need to be back in school, but we have to do it in different ways.
But part of the challenge, I think, in my reporting during the pandemic, I spoke with a psychiatrist who has basically taken on pandemics as his subject and looking at the psychology of pandemics going back to, you know, I think any literature that he could get on pandemics going back, I think, to times like the Greek times.
Wow.
But he said the one thing that he could see that happened in each pandemic going back throughout history is that as soon as the tribulation is over, the general population kind of says, what pandemic? They kind of have immediate amnesia.
Yeah.
Is that something that you worry about?
I do think it's easy to get complacent. Have you heard about the emotional life cycle of disasters? Have you seen that as well?
No, please tell me more.
It tends to be with any disaster, and this is kind of an extended one, an emergency, that you initially have this kind of rise of heroic response. You know, we're all in this together, we're West Virginia strong, we can do this, everybody pitches in, they do remarkable things, and it's just amazing those first several, you know, whether if it's a flood, it's the first several days, or in the pandemic, it's the first several months, you know, and you really are able to pull together and remarkably pitch in together.
Right.
And then kind of the reality hits. You know, this is getting old, and we start to kind of get discouraged, and we get frustrated, and we get angry, and people start to blame each other, and there's, you know, dissent and frustration, and things kind of get much further down.
Right.
And then over time, you kind of come to terms with the fact that, okay, we are here, and we've, you know, life is going to have to go on, and we've got to find ways to make it work. And you start to work together again to come to terms with the new normal. And over time, get back to that new normal. Sometimes that new normal is actually more functioning than where you were to begin with. Sometimes it's not. And so our hope is, I think with resiliency in communities, the hope is that we will learn things through that and actually have stronger functioning as communities afterwards. There's that opportunity that we could get to that point, or do we stay fractured? And so I hope that we will be able over time to get to that higher level of community functioning.
Dr. Kathy Slimp, I'm so grateful that you gave me this time to speak about these issues today. Thank you so much.
Lovely. Thank you, Trey.
That was Dr. Kathy Slimp, who was, until recently, the West Virginia Commissioner of Public Health. She spoke with host Trey Kay of our Us and Them podcast about how the state is faring in its response to the pandemic. You can download Us and Them wherever you get your podcasts or listen online at wvpublic.org. Us and Them is supported in part by the Claude Worthington Benedum Foundation and the West Virginia Humanities Council. The new novel, Poison Flood, by Jordan Farmer, is set against the backdrop of an environmental disaster based loosely on the 2014 West Virginia water crisis that poisoned the water of 300,000 West Virginia residents for more than a week. The novel includes murder, theft, and riots related to the environmental disaster, but there is a deeper meaning to the work, according to Farmer. He recently discussed the book with Eric Douglas by Zoom.
What do you hope your readers for Poison Flood take away from the book?
Well, I think, first of all, I just want them to be entertained, of course. I think that any art that doesn't entertain you or connect with you on some kind of emotional level, if it's all just moral, then I think it fails the test of what art should do. So at first, I want them to be entertained and engaged and to have some kind of emotional reaction to the characters, where they, you know, love them or hate them or feel sympathetic towards them and have some kind of empathetic response, hopefully.
Your character Hollis, he was interesting too. In the, he's obviously a tremendously talented musician, but he also has a pretty significant disability that he's dealing with. Why did you decide to throw that into the mix?
Well, I wanted to write a story with where somebody, a narrator or a protagonist, had what I would refer to as an unconventional body. I kind of have one myself. I have a bone disorder that's stunted my overall growth, so I'm about 5 foot tall. And when I was younger and was really interested in literature and books, I was never finding characters who had these kind of different physical bodies or were physically different in some way. And if I did find a story about them, it was always a story that was entirely concerned with the struggle of being physically different. It was never moments of them succeeding in business or love or making art or something else. It was always just focused on the body itself.
Hollis deals with the stressful events in his life. He begins composing music in his head and then literally has to get a guitar and compose music to help himself calm down. What's the roots behind that? Are you a musician yourself?
No, I'm not a musician myself. I play a little bit of a bad punk rock and sort of cowboy chord country guitar, but I wouldn't call myself a musician. Being a creative guy growing up in a small town without a writer group or people who were interested in the same kind of art forms I was, a lot of my friends were musicians. And I think I was deeply influenced by, you know, the kind of music I grew up around. My grandfather giving me Johnny Cash records and stuff to listen to when I was younger. So I wanted to write about the creative process, but I wasn't necessarily interested in the idea of writing about writing. Those kind of books don't always interest me. And I thought that I like music and I like the performative aspect of music.
Is your next book also set in West Virginia? Is that something you plan to continue, or are you moving elsewhere with the next one?
I've set this one, The Poison Flood, and the next manuscript I'm working on, they take place in a sort of a fictional town in West Virginia, much like, you know, Faulkner wrote about a fictional area of Mississippi. So it's called Coopersville County, which is my way of being able to have a town similar to the communities that I've grown up in, but also not have to have complete and total realism.
Are you at all concerned about people saying, well, that's just some West Virginia story, and not being interested because it is such a small kind of remote place?
I had this idea when I was younger that there just wasn't a place for stories or a desire for stories from small towns or rural America or places where I'm from. Now I'm not so much sure that's true. Now I think that as long as you're telling an interesting, engaging story and the themes are something that anyone, anywhere can understand, it's the sort of like daily struggles of life or the universal ideas of what it means to be a person, I think that people will engage with it regardless of the area. I think your first concern is simply to tell an engaging story.
That was Jordan Farmer speaking with Eric Douglas about his new novel, Poison Flood. The book was released in May by Putnam Publishing. You can hear this and other author interviews on our website at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our Appalachia Health News Project is made possible with support from CAMC and Marshall Health. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Glynis Board, Caitlin Tan, Jessica Lilly, Kara Lofton, Liz McCormick, Brittany Patterson, Eric Douglas, Corey Nollinger, Emily Allen, and Roxy Todd. I'm your host and producer this morning, Dave Mistich. Thanks for listening.